decreed by the sovereign. Now what we did here, your typical lawsuit is limited to 15 pages. Okay? Now, if you got a complex lawsuit, you can go back to the court and ask permission to have more than 15 pages. I've never seen a problem, not to date anyway, with having 16 or 17 pages. The whole idea is they want to keep this thing compressed. You know, they don't want to make a project out of every lawsuit. And normally you should be able to state your lawsuit in that space. But because of the way we do it, it's going to take a lot more space. We're putting in all the evidence at once. We're giving them lots to read. We're putting in all the law at once. We're putting in all the arguments at once. So this is really going to make this thing explode. So what we do, the rule, the 15-page rule, does not apply to exhibits. Okay? So put your evidence as exhibits. Okay? Don't include it in the main body. Put the law of the case, in other words, the sovereign's decree of the law, you put that in the exhibit. So that's what we did here. We said Exhibit G is incorporated by reference as though fully stated herein. And that's a great phrase. You ought to learn that one. Whatever it is incorporated by reference as though fully stated herein. If you have a cause of action, you remember I said here you have a cause of action. You state all the facts, whatever it is, and you have your arguments and so forth. That's one cause of action. Then you go to the next cause of action. In the next cause of action, all the facts are the same. The only difference is how you interpret them. So what you do is you take those paragraphs that were from the first cause of action, paragraphs 1 through 10, and you say, in your second cause of action, you say, paragraphs 1 through 10 of the first cause of action are incorporated by reference as though fully stated herein. And so that makes it real easy to say a lot in a little space. And that helps you to avoid the 15-page limit problem. So you incorporate it by reference. That's what we did here. We incorporated the law of the case where it's decreed by the sovereign by reference. And we'll get back to that in a minute. Then the final section here is you have a request for relief. This is the prayer. And basically you're saying to the court what you want from the court. Okay? You say to the court what you want from the court. So you tell it that you want X number of dollars. You want an order from the court directing the opposition to do something in particular. Whatever it is that you're asking for, this is where you put it. You also put in there that you ask for the court to award whatever else the court thinks you deserve. Now, technically, you don't need that sentence. It's a well-established fact, or a law, actually case law, that the court can give you anything that you merit. Okay, even if you didn't ask for it.
I don't see it here.
That's right. I didn't put it there. But let's go to the example here. So, here we have, all right, paragraph 1, introduction. All right, we go down through all this stuff, what each person did. Got quite a few paragraphs in the first cause of action. Second cause of action. Paragraphs 1 through 27 of the first cause of action are included by reference as though fully stated herein. So that 27 paragraphs, actually, that's everything up front, isn't it? So we're including that, and then we go on to say whatever else we have to say. And as you can see, this is actually relatively short. We start with paragraph 28 and finish with paragraph 32. Okay, so it's only four paragraphs. And yet we said as much here as was said in the first cause of action. Then we have the third cause of action. Right.
Can you explain the wording of what you say in paragraph 29?
29, okay. A right plaintiff reasonably expects to proceed without injury, secure in his capacities. By right, plaintiff reasonably expects to exercise his right to negotiate and to enter a contract. Yeah, because what was happening, the person sitting there negotiating a contract with this car company, and the cops walk in.
Okay, that's referring to the contract. That's the actual case, the whole issue, the reason.
Yeah, that's part of this case, right. You know, hey, we're in the middle of contract negotiations and already you're doing arrest. We haven't even had an opportunity to commit a crime.
Okay.
Not that we were going to commit one anyway, but okay, so yeah. So right there, it's trespass on the case. Interfering with the contract. Defendants have a legal right to use due care and not cause an injury to plaintiff or interfere with said rights in any way. Defendants breach that duty by proximately or legally, directly and indirectly causing the injuries to plaintiff. The damages claimed are all a result of the injuries. Okay, then we, in the vicarious liability, we copied the first 27 paragraphs again. And then a little philosophizing here. Power is never without responsibility, and when authority derives in part from the government's thumb on the scales, the exercise of that power by private persons becomes closely akin to some respects to its exercise by government itself. Of course, we're referring to these judges and all who are doing these things. And I want you to know that that wording came directly out of a Supreme Court case. I didn't make that up. I like to put the wording, when I do my research, I find these jewels of wording, I put them in without attribute, okay? And of course, they all brush them off. But then when it comes decision time, this is what we claimed, and here's what the court said. Looks like a match. Okay?
Judge Rehnquist, by Judge Rehnquist on Nelson.
Right. You see, the rule of case law is that the case law does not apply unless you have a match. Okay? If there's a perfect match, then we expect a perfect duplication of the decision. Well, looks like a match to me.
Yeah, but how about dicta versus decision?
Well, it says, what about dicta as compared to opinion? Okay? Now, this is true. When you read these things, your decisions from the Supreme Court or from the appellate court or even from a trial court, the decisions basically are divided into two parts. One part's called dicta and the other's called opinion. The opinion is the meat, okay? That's what the decision is all about. The dicta is all philosophizing and evaluation and discussion and so forth, but it isn't the case. Now, a lot of people misquote cases. They pick up the dicta and think it's like opinion. And I'll give you a perfect example of that. Everybody ever heard of the Dred Scott case? Does anybody know what the decision was?
Yeah.
Okay, you know. Anybody else know what that decision was?
Okay.
Yeah, take a chance.
I think so. You can take your property where you want to and steal your property.
Nope.
Wait.
That was not the decision.
Repeat that.
Yeah, okay. He said his answer was that he thinks that the Dred Scott decision was that you can take your property wherever you want, and what was the rest?
It's still your property.
It's still your property. No, that wasn't the decision. Okay? And by the way, that's a good point that I believe was covered in the dicta, but that was not the... Anybody ever hear of the... and we'll get back to Dred Scott. Anybody hear of Marbury versus Madison?
Yes.
Okay, that's another frequently quoted, or I should say misquoted case. Anybody know what the decision was on there? It was the same decision as was in the Dred Scott case. Okay, here's what it was. The court said, in both cases, the court said, we can't make a decision. We have no jurisdiction. That was the decision. In the Dred Scott case, if you read the first paragraph, they tell you what they think the basic issue is. And they're not too subtle about it either. They acknowledge that this is a question about jurisdiction. And when they got to the end, they said, we don't have it. And everything in between, it's a long opinion, you know, many pages. But it still came down to, when you read the actual opinion, it only takes about one paragraph, and it's a small paragraph at that. Okay. We have no jurisdiction. We can't decide.
So it was published otherwise.
Well, no.
In the press.
Well, everybody picked up and reads the dicta and they think that's the opinion. Yes.
The President of the United States in a recent speech said it was the case. He never said decision.
Yeah, I referred to the case, right.
Power is money in the Black's Law Dictionary, I believe.
Well, certainly money exerts an influence, but if you there's two definitions of power. There's the legal definition, and then there is the definition that we use in day-to-day English and in slang. Which language are you referring to?
The Black's Dictionary says power is money. So it says money is never without responsibility. And when authority derives its part from the government's...
That's from a case, from a thumb on the scales. Yeah, you know, the government has a thumb on the scale, changing the reading, influencing things. Well, the thing is that, well, I don't know where we're going with that. But yeah, the Dred Scott case, right. Marbury versus Madison and the Dred Scott case, both of those were the same decision, which is we have no decision. We can't make a decision.
Marbury versus Madison, that's the case you're looking for the Second Supreme Court?
Yeah, I guess it was Second Supreme Court. I'm not sure.
No, the First Supreme Court.
It's where this guy was going
to
be...
You were looking for another Supreme Court.
Oh, well, yeah, that would be the Supreme Court that we're interested in, I think.
I sent you an email on that recently, mm-hmm. and it showed the biographies of all the Supreme Courts,
uh-huh.
all the locations.
Oh, great.
Did you get that email?
Probably. I didn't read it, though.
Okay. But it's the one you're looking for. And it,
you send me a ton of email, you know.
No,
I finally start...
I only go there once a week.
I save it. I save all your emails for research.
Well, this one you got to look at because it has the biographies of the Supreme Courts, has... who the leaders were at the moment and where they were located, their locations.
Uh-huh.
But the state of where they had the hurricane, New Orleans.
Louisiana.
They have a different court, and they may have a separate Supreme Court. They said in New York, the Supreme Court is like our superior court. Their Supreme Court is our superior court. So some states change
yeah.
the Supreme Court. But I think Louisiana might be looked at for a...
Well, Louisiana is a Napoleonic law state.
That's correct. But they
okay.
do have a Supreme Court there. Separate. It's a separate Supreme Court.
Yeah. But that's not... That's every state has its own
Supreme
system
Court.
Of way of doing things. But then there's the federal Supreme Court, which is what we were talking about at the beginning there.
I understand.
With Madison versus Marbury.
But if you look at that biography, it shows all the locations of Supreme Court
okay.
and who
I'll
ran
it out.
At the time. So Marbury would be in one of those spaces
okay.
at the time.
Thank you.
Can you take common law action into Louisiana?
Yes. Absolutely, yes. The reason is because it's true it's a Napoleonic law state. And it's true they do not recognize common law inside their legal system. Again, you know, are you in Mexico or you're here? California uses Mexican law if there's no California law. Okay? But on the other hand, if you are in the Mexican law arena, then California law doesn't apply. So it's whose house are you in as to which laws apply. You're sovereign. As a sovereign, you are not accountable to any higher authority. The exception to that is that you are accountable to a jury of 12. Okay? And you are accountable to a majority of a grand jury. But short of that, you're not accountable to anybody. Okay? Well, now, you're in your sovereign capacity. The very essence of sovereignty is that the sovereign decrees the law. You've seen that case, right, in prior presentations. It's on the website. It's on the disk. Okay. If the very essence of sovereignty is that the sovereign decrees the law, then there is no law until the sovereign decrees it. All right, so if you decree the law, now you go to Louisiana. Louisiana gained admittance into the Union. In order to gain admittance, it had to be a republic. A republic, the sovereignty is in the people, and the individual people are each sovereign in a republic. It's not a democracy where the group is sovereign. it's a republic where the individuals are sovereign. And so if you are individually sovereign, if you decree the law, then you will decree what kind of court you have.
Where do you find a good definition of republic?
Believe it or not, in Black's Law Dictionary. No, I'll show you right here. We go to the foundation. We go to republic versus democracy. And we skip down a little ways. Okay, can you read that? Here, I'll enlarge it. Start off with a democracy on the third one. The form of government in which the sovereign power resides in and is exercised by the whole body of free citizens. Either directly or indirectly through representatives. Now, you look up above, you have government, republican government. It's one in which the powers of sovereignty are vested in the people and are exercised by the people, either directly or through representatives. So one, the democracy is the whole group. In a republic, it's each individual one. If the individual can be deprived of his sovereignty, in other words, if he's subject to Louisiana law, then what good is, I mean, what does that do to the meaning of your life in Louisiana? That make sense? And those came right out of, they even came out of the worst edition, fifth edition. Well, maybe the sixth is worst, I don't know. Back to this. This explains vicarious liability, by the way. The purpose of imposing vicarious liability is to ensure the costs of injuries resulting from defective actions are placed on the source of the actions and others who make the actions possible, rather than on injured persons who are powerless to protect themselves. So in that bicycle case, here this person is regulated, controlled, reviewed, trained by the state. Well, the state's responsible. That person has an accident. It's his fault. State's responsible because they're involved in the process. It could be argued that they did not do their job. They didn't train that person well enough, regardless of the fact that it was a 17-year-old teenager.
So you won that state against the state, that case against the state. Is that right?
That was a case against the state, right? But it was also against the original drivers.
And their parents.
And their parents. Right. So, eventually settled for, settled out of court with the parents for
$15,000.
The insurance paid it. They were let off the hook. The state was not let off the hook.
So
you see, the thing is that you can settle with individual participants without affecting the whole. Well, you subtract from it. If you got, we now have to take $15,000 and subtract it from the $2 million that we're suing for. So there's a big savings there for the state. I mean, they think in those terms. So, all right. Okay. So now we have the request for relief. We'll get back to the law last. Okay. So here's the request, the prayer. In other words, plaintiff. Oops, went too far. Okay, for that cause of action, therefore, plaintiff brings his suit. Now, this is a customary wording that goes with common law actions, paragraph 38. You don't have to have it there, but it's long time tradition, yes.
On the previous point, did they essentially say, please, we'll pay you the $15,000, please let us not pay for more attorney?
Not pay for our attorney.
Yeah, do we? Yeah, if we pay you $15,000, can we go home and not have to keep showing up in court, please?
Absolutely. Yeah, they got a total guarantee. It's finished. They're free from further out. Now, that does not mean that the state can't come back and sue them.
But your business with them is concluded.
Yes. Yeah, they're off the hook as far as we're concerned.
Yeah, that's a good way of doing business.
Yeah. Well, you know, we looked at the case. It, in one sense, it really was an accident. Okay. I mean, the person did violate right-of-way. That person came to a full stop at the stop sign. Here's the bicycle. And then that person started up again and hit the bicycle. So there was some failure of vision here in seeing the bicycle. Because we know they didn't do it on purpose. Okay, so there's the accident happened. Well, I mean, the father was a working stiff, worked all their life for the home. I mean, we could have grabbed their home, okay? But why do that? We had a deep pocket already. Okay? So, I mean, it boiled down to a choice. Who's going to pay these medical bills? $50,000. Either the perpetrator is going to pay it, or the victim's going to pay it. Well, it doesn't seem right to have the victim pay it. So, but on the other hand, the state was not objecting to us settling. I mean, we were in court talking about it, and the state did not object to the settlement discussions that were going on between the plaintiff and the individual. So when we settled, that's fine. That left the state. They're still part of the lawsuit. And they demurred, which means they admitted all the facts. Anyway, it's kind of a fun case. All right, so here's what we asked for. We said, in this case here, this is the basically a false imprisonment. We want judgment on all causes of action, whatever we ask for there. In addition to that, we want general damages in the sum of $50,000 multiplied by the number of days in constructive and actual imprisonment. Loss of earnings according to proof. Well, you could be out on bail.
Well, let me repeat the question.
What's the difference between constructive and actual imprisonment? Actual imprisonment means you're behind bars. Constructive imprisonment means you may be out on bail, but you're still under the thumb of the court. You're not free to do what you want when you want. There's conditions on that bail. Okay, so you're constructively in jail all that time. And we said we want $50,000 for each day that you're not free. You know, giving up your rights, or actually they were taken away. So and we want the court to enter a declaratory judgment that the defendants have acted arbitrarily and capriciously, have abused their discretion, and have acted not in accordance with law, but under color of law. So, a declaratory judgment. In fact, you can sue for a declaratory judgment. If you have an actual dispute going on between you and another party, you don't have to wait until an injury is done. You can go to the court and say to the court, hey, which one of us is right so that we can continue our business? A typical example might be, well, here's a good one. A lot of people have driver's license issues. Okay? Why should I have a driver's license? Well, now, I do not recommend to anybody that you drive without a driver's license. Okay? Not arbitrarily. For a simple reason, it's just a source of trouble. I mean, you're right, you've heard of being dead right, you know. You're right, but you're dead. You're right, but they still do damage, they throw you in jail, or they confiscate your car, or all kinds of stuff like that. So, the hassle that you have to go through to drive without a driver's license really takes the fun out of it. Okay? Now, the way to put the fun back into it is to go ahead and get a driver's license without prejudice as a first step. But whether you do that first step or not, at the very least, you should write a letter to the Department of Motor Vehicles saying that you intend to drive, you're going to drive, and you want to know what they're going to do about it. Okay? Am I really required? And if I am, what do you do if I don't go along with the program? Then they write back a letter saying, well, if you don't have a driver's license, the next time we catch you, we're going to beat you up. We're going to put you in jail. We'll take your car. Well, now you have an issue, don't you? Hey, I don't think you're right. So now you sue the Department of Motor Vehicles, you take it to court, and you ask for a declaratory judgment declaring the positions of the parties. Who's right here? DMV right, or am I right? Do I have my sovereignty when I'm not engaged in commerce? Or am I still under the thumb of the DMV? All right? Then you get a decision from the court, and since you're the plaintiff, you're probably the court, right? And so you get a decision that you are sovereign. You're in your sovereign capacity. And that you're not required, so long as you're not engaged in commerce. Engaged in commerce in this case means carrying passengers or cargo for hire. As long as you're not engaged in commerce, you shouldn't have a license. No license required. And so you get a decision. You now have the court order the DMV to put on their public record that you're exempt. provided that, with the condition, provided that you're not engaged in commerce, because we, the people, have authorized the regulation of commerce. Okay? So I'm not going to go against my own orders as the people. But if I'm not engaged in commerce, why should I have a license? Right? And so then, the next time a cop stops you, he says, could I have your license? You can do like one fella did. He had a little homemade license, but he had the right license number on there, handed to the cop. Cop looks at it, kind of shakes his head, and says, well, all right. The guy says, that's my license. Look it up. Cop went back, gone for a few minutes while he went through his process, you know, by radio, checking. A few minutes later, he comes back. He says, hands it to him. He says, says they told me to leave you alone. I don't know why. He says, have a nice day. See, that, I think, is the proper way to handle that problem.
What number did he give
him? He gave him his old driver's license number, but the record had been updated. He went through the trouble to get his record updated because the cop would believe the state when the state tells him to leave him alone. He won't believe the driver if the driver tells him he's sovereign, see? I mean, the cop's just out there basically following instructions. Don't expect a cop to be a thinker. The average IQ of a policeman is 104. That's the same IQ of the average bank teller or the average secretary. Just because he got a little police training does not mean that he's smart. Okay? And we're talking averages. There's some smart ones, some dumb ones, but the average is 104. So, the one thing that 104s can do well is follow instructions from the state. They do that very well. So put the instructions on the state records, do it with a declaratory judgment, and then you're home free. No hassle other than the hassle of going to court, and that's a lot better than fighting to get your car back and going to jail and all that sort of garbage. Anyway, that's my suggestion on that issue. So here we're asking for the court to enter declaratory judgment stating what the position of the parties are and who done what. And that the court enter a declaratory judgment that defendant's actions were in excess of statutory jurisdiction, authority, and short of statutory right. That the court permanently enjoin defendants from interfering in any way with plaintiff's lawful right to negotiate and enter into contracts. So we don't want to hear any more about this from them. When plaintiff is in the future out there negotiating future contracts, we don't want any more cops walking in and interfering with that. So we want a court order enjoining the state, stopping the state, in other words, from future interference. And that the court enter a declaratory judgment, that the records of the court, not of record, are impeached for want of jurisdiction in the court or judicial officers, for collusion between the parties, and for fraud in the parties offering the record in respect to the proceedings. Okay? So, because you see, you had the original criminal court, and that was an inferior court. And then we have the court of record, which is a superior court. Now, the inferior court had the name superior court, but the name does not make the court. What makes the court is how a court acts. And that superior court was acting as an inferior court. So the court of record was acting as a superior court, and it outranked the other court. And all inferior courts can be sued in a superior court. So that's what we did here. And now we're saying to the court, we want a declaratory judgment that says that the records in the inferior court are no good. They're impeached. That's what we're asking for here. And we're also asking for attorney's fees and that the court grant plaintiffs such other and further relief as the court deems proper. And for interest as allowed by law, because once we reach the judgment, which we have, interest accrues from that point on. And for cost of suit incurred. And then because this was a verified complaint, we have the paragraph 52, I declare under penalty of perjury the foregoing facts are true and correct to the best of my knowledge. And as a technicality, we probably should have left off the best of my knowledge. Because if you have an escape, then what confidence can we have you're telling the truth? But nevertheless, it's there. You know, I don't know who's going to prosecute that one. There's no basis because everything is true in the first place. Everything was verifiable. And you sign it and you seal it. A round one. See if I can enlarge that further.